the Moment Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. The Democrats' ideological tug-of-war between moderates and progressives was on display at this weekend's DNC meeting to debate or not debate climate change. Plus, if you're stopping on the freeway right next to a wildfire, relax.
Whenever we close down freeways, you're probably safest in those areas. Public safety officials will never lock you down or block you in an area that's going to trap you in danger.
It's ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for starting your week off with us. Coming up, with college kids heading back to campus, we'll hear how students and faculty are reacting to recent scandals at the University of Southern California.
When we go out and I give a public lecture and somebody mentions I'm from the University of Southern California, there's a titter in the room.
Plus, Democratic Party delegates voted this weekend to keep presidential candidates out of a debate on climate change, and naturally, criticism has followed. We'll discuss that in a few minutes. First, though, that brush fire in Eagle Rock that might have affected a few of you yesterday. It erupted right around 4 p.m. between the 2 and the 134 freeway interchange and spread quickly, scorching 30 acres. Now it's 40% contained, but it prompted evacuations of about 100 homes in the Glen Oaks Canyon neighborhood on Sunday, and it left many motorists on the 134 just stranded as fire crews battled that blaze. So what lessons were learned about future evacuation plans in the area? To answer that, we have Anita Shandy, Public Information Officer for the Glendale Fire Department. Welcome to Take Two.
Thank you so much.
Now, yesterday's fire affected residents right along East Glen Oaks Boulevard from Mount Carmel Drive to Bywood Drive. There's only one road in and out of that evacuation area, and the orders weren't given until around 6 p.m. Why did it take that long?
So as soon as we realized that the fire was kind of creeping towards the homes in the Glen Oaks Canyon, that is when we issued the evacuation orders. We're very protective of that area because of the access points being so not accessible. So as soon as we saw that the fire might be kind of coming towards that direction, we decided the right thing to do is to start our evacuation orders. So once the incident command team realized that, yeah, you know what, this fire is probably going to be heading towards this way, let's get our residents out, let's make sure they're safe. There is a reverse 911 call system we do have in Glendale. So calls went out immediately to these residents notifying them to evacuate. On top of that, right away, our Glendale Police Department went door to door, knocking on all the doors, getting the residents out, making sure that they're aware. If there's residents that have health issues that can't move themselves, we made sure to help them out as well.
That evac order, that's got to be a tricky call, though, right, Anita? Because it's like, you know, it's an inconvenience for people to be evacuated, but it's also an inconvenience to have your house burned down. So it's like a tricky situation to make that call or not.
Inconvenience is one thing, but safety is our number one priority. We would rather everybody be safe. We'd rather residents get out and maybe inconvenience you for a short period of time. But if that ensures the safety of you and your family and your pets, that is our priority. We will do everything we can to protect your homes, but our number one priority is the safety of our residents.
Talking to Anita Shandy, Public Information Officer for the Glendale Fire Department. When there's only one way in and out, what's the plan for getting people out quickly?
You know your community the best. You know your neighborhood the best. You don't necessarily have to wait for us to issue the evacuation orders. If you don't need to be home at that time, if you can gather your family together, get your stuff out, get ready to go so you don't wait until everyone is trying to get out at the same time. And that's probably a great idea. That way, in these areas where there is one way, one out, a lot of the residents, if they kind of just get ready to go out on their own, that would be a great help as well.
Now, ideally, yeah, you're right. Ideally, anyone that lives in Southern California or lives near a canyon should be ready because we live with fire danger all the time. But Anita, all you got to do is look at how many people have earthquake kits to know that people are people and they don't get things ready. So did everything go according to plan in your book?
It did. We were grateful. Our residents in this area specifically are very in tune because they know of the restrictions kind of in the area. So they're great partners with us. They know what they need to do, and they were great in getting their stuff ready and going. There's always going to be residents in any area. We understand homes are very sentimental to people. They want to stay back and feel like they're protecting them. But again, we will do everything we can to protect your homes. We just need you to evacuate and get out and be safe. And we will do everything we can to protect your home. So please don't ever feel like you have to stay back to protect your home or anything that you're going to do is going to save your home more than we will do for you. Get out, get your family, get your pets, and just evacuate the area for your own safety.
You mentioned earlier people sitting on the freeway. One of our listeners was sitting between Central and Glendale on the 134 for about 45 minutes. She said she felt trapped. What plans are in place to ensure commuter safety in a situation like yesterday?
Whenever we close down streets, freeways, you're probably safest in those areas. So although you might feel like you're not moving and how am I going to get out and where am I going to go, public safety officials will never lock you down or block you in an area that's going to trap you in danger. So I understand kind of the feeling of, you know, why am I sitting here and I feel like it's close and I feel like it's trapped, but they are actually keeping you from where you would be in danger. So best thing to do is have patience, just kind of sit back. Again, check in with the news agencies. News agencies do a great job of keeping in touch with us and getting information out to the public. So turn on the radio, check social media. But if you are in a place where you're being held, especially by public officials, so if, you know, if Caltrans or CHP has shut down the freeway, they are keeping you in a safe place.
Anita, I trust you. I absolutely trust you. But my goodness, that is a tough sell to tell someone, okay, don't go anywhere. Stay right there, even though there's a fire right there.
Yeah, sometimes because when you only see your vision, you know, when especially in these situations, but when you're dealing with these type of big events, there's so many different agencies with different aspects of views, things that you're not seeing, things that you're not aware of. So our number one job is public safety. So we are, without question, will never put you in a position to be unsafe.
One more thing, fires, an inevitable part of life in Southern California, always top of mind. That said, any specific evacuation lessons that maybe were learned from yesterday's fire?
Mostly it's just a matter of being ready. And I know we say that so much, like you said, with earthquakes, you know, we talk about it so much. We're in California between earthquakes and brush fires and wildfires. It's kind of an inevitable situation, but yet we don't do what we need to do sometimes to be prepared ahead of time. And that is what's going to make the biggest difference for you. If you are ready to go, if your papers, your emergency kits, your medication, your plan, just make sure that's ready to go. Because once the incident happens, your time is so limited. And you never know what's driving it, whether it's weather. And in 5 minutes, everything can change.
Anita Shendy is the public information officer for the Glendale Fire Department. Anita, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, now to San Francisco and some politics. There were a lot of presidential hopefuls at the Democratic National Committee meeting this weekend, and also a lot of protesters. Party delegates considered a motion to prevent presidential candidates from taking part in a debate focused on climate change. Now, despite the protests, the motion passed. That move has reignited a criticism of party leadership that they may be out of touch with the party's younger voters. Many of them see climate change as a top issue. Let's get more details on what happened over the weekend from Carla Marinucci. She's senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Hello, Carla.
Hey. Good to be with you.
Good to have you, Carla. Now, the meeting, well attended. I should know how to do that. I am a radio professional,
yeah.
After all. 12 presidential hopefuls were there. But part of the weekend that seems to be garnering the lion's share of attention is the vote to hold a presidential debate focused on climate change. So lay it out for us. What were the different sides of this debate?
Well, you know, as you noted, there were a lot of very impassioned younger protesters, millennials from groups like the Sunrise Movement this weekend, saying that the climate change issue cannot wait, that it's not just the future of the Democratic Party that's at stake here, but the future of the entire planet, and that if any issue deserves intense attention from Democratic Party candidates, it is this one. And they noted that two-thirds of the Democratic candidates in the race backed the idea of a specific TV debate on climate change. But, that, you know, on the other side, you had many Democrats present, including Simone Sanders, who is Joe Biden's chief strategist, you know, making a strong argument saying, look, you can't do a specific debate on this issue and ignore a lot of the other issues that have impassioned followers. What are they supposed to tell, for instance, the survivors of Parkland or El Paso who want a debate on gun control? Or what about the Democrats who want a debate on race issues or criminal justice reform or the economy? So the question is, you know, how many debates can voters take? And how many will they be able to focus on? And they noted that there's going to be a CNN town hall on this issue next month. And so that's where it came down to. Wow. They lost on an overwhelming vote, 222 to 137. on, you know, the idea yeah. of nixing the idea of a climate debate.
And we heard those protesters earlier chanting a vote no as in vote against this motion. Now, climate change has already come up in this election. You mentioned how it's going to be coming up again in later debates and later discussions. But why is this a victory in the eyes of party leaders like DNC chair Tom Perez?
Well, you know, people like Perez have logistical concerns. They're basically saying you cannot change the rules in the midstream of a presidential election. It's too disruptive to the candidates. Remember that, you know, there's already one debate a month, and these debates require an enormous amount of preparation that takes time away from the campaign trail. You know, and I think, look, Perez has another issue, and that is every debate is another forum where there's one possible outcome, and that is the Democrats bashing each other up there on stage. And the party leaders have got to be thinking, look, why do we need that when Donald Trump is trying to do that every day on Twitter? So for a lot of reasons, they're just saying, you know, let the current schedule stand and don't ask for trouble with an additional debate.
I'm wondering if, Joe Biden wasn't there this weekend. He was in New Hampshire. And he's been arguably the one that's been more moderate on climate change than some of the others. And I'm wondering if some of the ones that were there were itching to talk about it, to debate it, and couldn't because of this vote.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point. As we mentioned, a whole bunch of the Democratic candidates, 15 of them, were for this debate. I think it's very difficult for them to come out against it. But the issue is, you know, the Democrats on this issue have a big, very clear and stark difference with the Republican Party. Every one of their candidates, no matter who the candidate ends up being in the end, will provide a contrast to President Trump, who is essentially a climate denier. I mean, just this weekend, he was there at the G7, the only world leader not to attend a climate change forum. So Democrats have that advantage when it comes to the issue of climate change. And the big issue, I think, here is whether the younger progressive voters, those millennials that we saw this weekend in groups like the Sunrise Movement, will be energized and impassioned enough to come out for, say, a candidate like Biden or a candidate who maybe they don't support. If they're impassioned enough to go with that candidate rather than Trump, to, you know, whether they feel Trump is a bigger problem. So that's the problem Democrats have going forward when it comes to this issue of climate change.
Carla, once this vote came down and it wasn't going to be discussed, I did a scan of some conservative commentators just to hear what they were saying. And most of the tone of it was, see, their ideas on climate change are so crazy that they won't even allow them to talk about it. So I'm wondering, Carla, how big of an issue is this vote really? Because I can definitely see how it could make the party appear to be just as divided as ever.
Yeah, I mean, there was a circular firing squad kind of going on within the party this weekend, and I think that's what Democrats worried about, because what we saw was some missed opportunities. I mean, I, for one, watched them debate that issue about the debate for 2 hours.
Wow.
They
were debating to debate. Is that what you're saying, to be or not to be? That is the question?
Yes, yeah, okay. That's exactly right. But when you get down to it, I watched 13 candidates hit the stage and barely heard the I word, impeachment. I heard very little discussion on the economy, stupid. I mean, remember that phrase? And this was a weekend in which, by the way, the Dow Jones tanked 600 points, and there were real worries about the recession and the trade wars with Trump. So that stood out to me. I heard just one candidate, Andrew Yang, really talk about those matters substantially in depth, and that is the worry for a lot of Democrats watching this. That is, are they going to get lost in the debates on the debates as they go toward 2020? And you mentioned Joe Biden not there. I think a lot of Democrats came away from the DNC meeting with the feeling that no single candidate really has yet emerged as the sure thing to take on Donald Trump. And with the protests that we saw, there's still a lot of angst as to whether the Democrats can unify behind one candidate with a cohesive message that's going to energize voters in 2020.
So I'm wondering then, for the DNC in general, what was the point of the weekend?
Well, these were influential, important, many legislative folks and big donors. The candidates wanted to schmooze with those folks, and they may need them if there's a contested convention coming up. Some of those folks are super delegates. They get to vote on the second ballot, and who knows if that drama is going to come forth. But look, you got to prepare for it if you're the candidates.
Well, tick tock, because 6 months out from the Iowa caucus, what's your read on the state of the Democratic Party after what you saw this weekend?
I think the read is angst. I think the read is trying to figure out who is going to have that strong message. And as I said, the issue of the economy is still number one with voters, as is health care and pre-existing conditions. And that's one of a couple of the messages we really didn't see discussed in depth this weekend. I think Democrats know they've got to get there with all these debates going forward. And whether they do is going to make the difference on who's going to be in the White House come next November.
Carla Marinucci is senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Carla, thanks a lot.
Always good to be with you, A. Thanks.
And real quick, in case you missed it, California is again taking the Trump administration to court over its immigration policies, specifically going after a rule that would keep migrant families in detention. The news was announced earlier today by Governor Gavin Newsom and Attorney General Javier Becerra. The ruling question would sidestep the 1997 Flores settlement. That limits the amount of time children can be kept in detention to no more than 20 days and requires they be given food, water, and emergency medical treatment as needed. The new rule imposed by the administration would allow that time to be extended and set new regulations for detention facilities. All right, you hear all the time about how important diversity is in the casting of movies and TV shows. What someone sees or doesn't see on the screen can make folks, especially young folks, feel included or left out. Well, you can add the college classroom to that list. Coming up, how a UC campus is diversifying its pool of professors by looking at its students. That's ahead when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. The fall semester begins at the University of Southern California today. Students are coming to a campus that's been rocked by a series of scandals over the past 2 years and accusations that the university has not done enough to address them. KPCC's Emily Elena Dugdale visited the school to find out how students and faculty are reacting.
I've covered move-in week at colleges before, but USC has the stuff down to a science. Teams of student volunteers in cardinal and gold t-shirts swarm around a line of SUVs. First-year students swinging their new school lanyards jump out and put a year's worth of Bed Bath & Beyond products into giant rolling carts. The USC bookstore blares upbeat music that masks a parent's frantic run to the cash register for that last t-shirt to send a relative's back home. All of this is normal in the week prior to the start of the semester. But the cover of the student newspaper right outside the bookstore tells the story behind the glossy welcome posters. A photo of USC's brand new president, Carol Folt, above the headline, A Time to Rebuild.
We found out about this scandal before we got in or chose to go to the school.
Yeah, exactly.
I stop a pack of nearby first years exploring and ask them what they know about the past 2 years of USC scandal. Most don't want their names used.
Did the school like say anything when you guys were applying?
There's a letter on the portal. Yeah, a portal letter.
Do you remember what the letter said?
A student named Jong Bin spoke up.
They're asking for like us to maintain our trust in the admissions process.
Yeah. How did you feel when you read that?
I wasn't exactly reassured.
And neither is a lot of the USC community. As the number of scandals has grown, so have concerns about what some say is an inadequate response by USC leaders. Here's a recap of some of the biggest recent scandals. Carmen Pugliafito, a former medical school dean who held drug-fueled parties on and off campus, including one at a hotel where a young woman overdosed, was allowed to resign with a big cash payout. A former school gynecologist, George Tyndall, was accused of decades of sexual misconduct. Dozens of gay and bisexual students have accused former campus doctor Dennis Kelly of sexual abuse. And there was the nationwide admissions scandal, with wealthy parents paying big money to get their kids into elite universities, including USC. It's earned the school a mocking nickname, the University of Scandal and Corruption.
When we go out and I give a public lecture and somebody mentions I'm from the University of Southern California, there's a titter in the room.
That's law professor Ariella Gross. She's part of a group called the Concerned Faculty of USC. It sent letters to the school administration demanding transparency into the numerous investigations underway, as well as a bigger role for faculty in school governance.
If you have somebody molesting 50 or 200 students, you're going to be paying a settlement. That's going to happen. So what's the best way to handle this in the court of public opinion? It's always the cover-up that gets you anyway.
USC declined a request for an interview with President Bolt for this story. PhD candidate Chris Coombs says he'd like to be optimistic that Bolt and the trustees will involve students more in repairing the damage to the university's reputation. Coombs is involved in USC graduate student government and sits on a health subcommittee that was formed after the Tyndall sexual misconduct allegations surfaced.
The university administration needs to understand and trust that students know what's best for students.
But after so much turmoil, he says he's pretty jaded.
We're all always waiting on the next scandal. It's no longer if, but when.
Many students and faculty agree that USC can only move past the scandals if it addresses the systemic problems with the school's culture. Problems longtime professor Roberto Diaz says start with something as simple as the name for the school network, the Trojan Family.
Every time that I hear the Trojan Family, I cringe a little. This family analogy is wrong because it's almost like father knows best. And that's the end of the story.
He says it's a dysfunctional family, but not one that can't be healed. I'm Emily Elena Dugdale.
You can read more about USC's many scandals on laist.com. That's laist.com. Staying with higher education, colleges throughout California have a difficult challenge diversifying their faculty. Having a pool of teachers and professors who reflect the community not only creates better research, it also makes students feel like they belong. So the University of California at Merced has created a pipeline to meet these challenges, and it's yielding strong results. Reporter Felicia Mello went to see the program in practice and wrote about it for the news site Cal Matters. Felicia, welcome back to Take Two.
Thank you.
All right. First off, explain what this program does for students on campus.
Sure. So it's a summer undergraduate research institute, and it serves a population of students at UC Merced, which are a majority of them are the first in their families to go to college. It's a very ethnically diverse group of students. Many of them are on federal Pell Grants and come from low-income areas. And the program is designed to really prepare them to conduct original research and apply to graduate school. So they spend 9 weeks doing independent research projects under the supervision of a faculty member. But they're also in workshops that are designed to kind of uncover what they call the hidden curriculum of academia. So, you know, how do you write a CV and how is that different from a resume? How do you write a personal statement for graduate school? And also dealing with some of the psychological challenges that students face succeeding in academia, which can be an unfamiliar environment.
Now, I know you mentioned it mainly assists undergrad students, and it seems like that's important, right? Because if you don't get them early, they might think, well, that's not an option for me.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of the students I talked to said things like, you know, I had really no idea what graduate school was before I did this program, or I didn't know that there was funding available to pursue a PhD. And so a lot of what the program is doing, too, is kind of debunking these misconceptions about graduate school and allowing students to really envision themselves going on in academia.
Let's go back to 2014. That's when the program really got off the ground. What prompted the university to do this?
Well, I think UC Merced really took a look at the population of students they were serving and said, we have an opportunity to really make a difference in preparing a diverse group of students to succeed in academia. And there are summer research fellowship programs like this at other universities. So it's not unique to Merced, but what Merced did is took this kind of patchwork of programs and consolidated them under a single office. And the other thing that kind of makes Merced special is that because it's such a small school, it's only been around for 14 years, there are not that many graduate students. So the professors also kind of started to learn over time that these undergraduates could actually be extremely helpful on research projects. So what you see is at Merced, a larger percentage of students report that they're helping faculty with research than on any other UC campus.
We're talking to Felicia Mello with Cal Matters. Let's go over some of the program's successes, too, because it's had an impressive record at UC Merced, preparing students for academic careers. Many students, low-income, first-generation people of color. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, more undergraduates are doing this type of research than at other UCs. And the other interesting thing is that alumni of UC Merced are going on to earn doctorates at rates that are comparable to UCs that are considered more selective, such as UCLA and UC San Diego.
The barriers keeping students from pursuing careers in higher education. You mentioned imposter syndrome. You mentioned some of them have these misconceptions or these myths about what a graduate program is all about. What are some of those barriers?
Well, it's interesting because when I talked to Jorge Arroyo, who himself was a first-generation college student, now he directs the Center for Undergraduate Research at UC Merced, he said, you know, we talk to students about imposter syndrome, and it's that dynamic of feeling, you know, maybe I don't really belong in this space, or, you know, if I really stick my neck out by trying to write a paper or give a presentation, people are going to realize that I, you know, don't really know what I'm talking about. And it certainly can affect many of us, but it can particularly affect folks that are coming from families where they don't see a lot of other people around them who have already attended college. And so what Jorge was telling me is that in these programs, they say, look, imposter syndrome is there. It's not going to go away. You know, it can exist even after you go on to get a doctorate and be successful in your career. But what you can learn to do is to recognize it and to manage it and say, oh, the reason why I'm feeling so nervous about submitting this paper is that's my imposter syndrome acting up again, and to not so impeded by it. And when I talked to students, they said things like, you know, now that I've done this program, my shoulders are farther back when I give a presentation. You know, I'm confident and I know that I belong here.
Now, Central Valley students are noticing the campus. Admissions of local students are also increasing. You think this program has really raised UC Merced's profile?
I think that's part of it. I think overall, UC Merced is being recognized nationally in a number of different ways. U.S. News and World Report last year recognized the college for, I think it ranked it second among schools nationwide for exceeding expectations in terms of graduation rates. So UC Merced is still graduating students at lower rates than other UCs, but taking into account, you know, in this formula that U.S. News and World Report has, the financial resources of the campus, the backgrounds that students are coming from, they were performing at a much higher level than was expected. So I think that was one thing that was interesting. You might have seen there was a UC Merced undergraduate this year that was doing research in the Dakotas. He was a student who was interested in paleontology, had a fascination with dinosaurs, and unearthed a Triceratops skull. And this was all over the news. That also kind of helped, I think, bring extra media attention to the school. It's in the midst of a big expansion. If you go on campus, there are new buildings going up everywhere, and their goal is to be at 10,000 students by next year and to have the size of the campus approximately double. So it's going to be interesting to see that evolution. And in a way, you know, when you look at the UC system, the students that are in our public colleges now are looking increasingly like the students at Merced. They're much more ethnically diverse. They're often the first in their families to go to college. And so I think this kind of challenge that UC Merced is grappling with in terms of how do we make space for these students' talents and contributions in the academy is something that all of higher ed is really dealing with.
And I was going to ask about the rest of the UC system, if maybe they're looking to scale this idea to their campus, maybe tailor it to their locations.
Well, like I said, there are some other campuses that have these kinds of programs. But I think that some of the factors that we talked about that make Merced unique are, you know, the size of the campus and the fact that they kind of take an intentional approach to dealing with some of these psychological and social barriers that we discussed. I did talk to Merced's graduate dean, and she said, you know, even though other UCs are a lot larger than us, this might be something that could be implemented at the level of a school. You know, other campuses have these kind of smaller schools that students are concentrated in within the campus. And that might be a more practical level to start implementing more of these strategies.
That's Felicia Mello with Cal Matters telling us about the pipeline to increase faculty diversity on campus at UC Merced. Felicia, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
How do you know if the stuff you buy at your local cannabis shop is legit? You know, passing the smell test, so to speak. Well, first off, if you happen to be in an unlicensed shop, you're taking a chance right there. But second, even if the lower illegal pot shop price is a better fit for your budget, that doesn't mean you're getting the same products you'd get at a licensed place, even if it passes the eyeball test. That's next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Since recreational marijuana became legal in California in 2018, one part of the rollout that has not gone smoothly is keeping the black market in check. State and local law enforcement have taken measures to try and shut down illegal stores, only to have more pop up to replace them. Now, one way these shops not only stay open, but are projected to make nearly $9 billion this year is to stock their shelves with counterfeit cannabis products. The old phrase, buyer beware, applies because purchasing this stuff not only financially chokes the licensed shops, but could also pose a risk to your safety. James Quealy has been reporting on this for the LA Times. James, welcome back.
Hey, nice to be back.
All right. First off, tell us how many legal versus illegal pot shops are there in LA?
So legally, there's 187 dispensaries that have temporary licenses to operate. There's not a hard number on unlicensed shops. You'll get varying estimates. The LAPD had said earlier in the year it was 300. They now claim they've shut down enough that it's closer to 200. I also did an analysis earlier this year using Weed Maps, kind of, you know, comparing the listings on their site to the city records of the legal shops, and I found at least 220. So the number varies, but the point is there's definitely more legal shops than legal in LA.
And the difference in terms of how much that makes for those shops in terms of compared to the licensed ones is a big difference, right?
Yeah, I mean, the unlicensed shops, as you mentioned, they can sell. Their big competitive advantage is that they don't charge taxes on their products, so they're selling at a lower rate than the licensed shops, and some customers don't know the difference, so they will start complaining or stop patronizing altogether the legal shops because they just think they're, you know, gouging on prices, when in reality they're just abiding by the law.
Now, your reporting found that the illegal places rely on counterfeit cannabis products to make all the money, which puts a company such as Loudpack Farms in a bind. Tell us what they're dealing with.
So what Loudpack had told me, they are the proprietors of Kingpen, which is a fairly popular vape pen. If any of your listeners out there are routine visitors to dispensaries, they'll probably notice that red box with the playing card King that kind of looks a little zonked out of its head. Yeah. On the front. So what they had happen was they were noticing the vape was declining in popularity. They were getting a lot of complaints about its quality. They knew they hadn't changed the oil. They knew they had not changed the mechanism, the delivery device, and they start to find out that it's up being advertised in a bunch of stores that they don't do business with, that aren't licensed in the various cities that they do business in. So they changed the packaging, hoping to get ahead of the counterfeiters, and almost as quickly as they did that, the counterfeiters matched their new product. So that's cost them, you know, millions in design, in just junking a lot of merchandise to try to repackage it or rebrand it. I mean, it's caused them a massive problem, and they're not alone in dealing with that.
And Loudpack, you know, when they spent to repackage it, the black market started copying the new packaging almost right away.
Yeah, that's what they said. I mean, a lot of these packages are just sold. They're sold on websites sometimes out of the country that just mass produce, mass print. And yeah, they'll mimic anything they can to match popular legal cultivators, distributors, brands. Somebody who works for a downtown LA cultivator told me pretty much as soon as he posted his certain strain they were selling, its kind of quality approval, what it had passed at state certified labs, somebody printed it out, smacked it on the side of a bag,
Wow. And
pounds of that strain were suddenly starting to pop up in unlicensed dispensaries.
We're talking to James Quealy with the LA Times. One of the people you spoke to compared it to buying a fake Prada shirt at a flea market. In terms of quality, how big of a difference is there between the real and the phony stuff?
I mean, it's going to vary completely spot to spot, but again, it's not going through, quality control checks. It's not being tested for contaminants. As, we've written about in the past, the city attorney's office has raided certain unlicensed dispensaries in the city where they found pesticide-laden weed. I've definitely talked to other people, just customers, who will buy really popular, really well-regarded California vape pen brands. The Curvana Ascend is a really popular one, and among people I know, they've bought knockoffs sometimes at illegal dispensaries, and the oil will leak or it will taste really weird. It'll burn. It's just, there are reports of people getting sick. They are few and far between. I can't really vouch for it being a public health concern, but you're certainly not getting anything close to what is described on the box.
What about the packaging itself? How obvious are the fake ones?
So that, again, also varies. Really, if you want to avoid buying a counterfeit item, you kind of need to avoid going to an illegal shop. That is the easiest way to sidestep this. Mm-hmm. If you live in LA, for instance, use the DCR website. They have an interactive map. You can just type in your address or wherever you're standing, and it will give you directions to the nearest legal dispensary. Sometimes, otherwise, it's just going to be, if it's a package or a brand that you're familiar with, something you usually buy if you're a more regular user, and the packaging just looks different, or it's an item that you've never seen before. The one I mentioned in the story is Corova. They're very popular with these cookies they sell that are usually about 10 milligrams each. Then I walk into an unlicensed shop and I find a brownie advertises 1,000 milligrams of THC. Not only is that illegal to sell in California, and obviously you break that into small pieces unless you really don't want to have you really don't want to wake up for a day and a half. Other than that, that's not illegal to sell in California anyway. So.
And I gotta wonder though, James, if you're experienced, you'd know that doesn't jive. That's not right. The math doesn't work. But if you don't, and you're kind of just walking in there, I don't know if I'd know the difference.
No, you're right. I mean, it's that's why I said it's going to be hard for you to eyeball it unless you really not unless you really know what you're looking for, but unless you're at least a somewhat regular purchaser. But in general, even if you're a casual person, just visiting the city, just trying to try it out for the first time, I would really advise sticking to the DCR website and looking up your nearest legal distributor, because once you walk into an off the book shop, you really have no idea what you're buying.
What does the Bureau of Cannabis Control say? Are they getting a lot of complaints about the counterfeit cannabis?
So the complaint data I've come across, I don't really seem to think, and the reporting doesn't bear out that it matches the scope of the problem. The BCC said it's received 38 complaints through its online portal regarding this since December of 2017. Kingpin alone says they filed dozens of complaints with BCC and the Department of Health. And as I reported in the story, I walked into a handful of different illicit dispensaries in LA and found 5-6 different brands, different products. If every single instance was being reported, it would be way higher than the amount that is being reported to the state. BCC is, with this issue, much like they are with unlicensed dispensaries. They're doing this public awareness campaign. They call it Get Weed Wise, where they're trying to educate people on some of what we've just been talking about, how to tell the difference between a licensed and unlicensed shop, where to look up that information. And they might have more specific information as far as how to tell with packaging. But that's a good place for people who are curious to go, is to start checking out the videos they're putting up, because those are very helpful.
Yeah, I don't know how many people self-report, James, when it comes. I'm buying illegal stuff or stuff that's not legal.
You make a very convincing argument.
Yeah. Now, okay, so I mentioned earlier, how can you go to a flea market and buy a Prada shirt that probably isn't Prada? Because I'm wondering, by now, don't people know exactly what they're getting depending on where they're getting it?
Some people might know, some people might not. Like we said, LA, a lot of the cannabis market, there's going to be plenty of tourists, plenty of first-time visitors to Los Angeles that just want to try it out. They may not know the difference. And also some people do not care. There is a significant price difference between unlicensed and licensed shops. So it's not that everybody keeping the lights on these places is being deceived. A lot of people are knowingly buying these products because they don't want to pay the state and city taxes, which is understandable. It does jack up the rate to a severe degree. So it's not entirely, like I said, it's not entirely people being fooled.
So you got the legal company like Loudpack jumping through all the financial and licensing hoops to be legit. Now they're paying even more to rebrand and repackage their products. I mean, how long can a company like that stay afloat this way?
I mean, that's for them to decide. I mean, they are not claiming that they are in fiscal peril or anywhere near going out of business, but it certainly just it raises the difficulty for a legal market that, like we said, it's already struggling with the licensed stores to get them to be able to compete with the unlicensed stores. It's just another in a long line of difficulties right now for these legal shops. You know, it's not a short term immediately. People are going to be out of jobs or businesses, but over the long arc of history with California's marijuana market, this is something that does need to get fixed if it's going to get off the ground properly.
That's James Quigley of the LA Times telling us about how counterfeit cannabis products are fueling California's black market for weed. James, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so today, in case you didn't know, it's Public Banking Lobby Day. You'll be forgiven if that was not on your calendar. But on this day, those in support of a public bank in California descended on Sacramento to push for Assembly Bill 857. That bill, if it becomes law, would allow cities and other municipalities to establish their own government-run banks. Sure, it seems wonky, but the bill is gaining some traction. It's been heard and amended in a half dozen committee hearings, and the governor appears to like the idea. It needs three more votes before heading to his desk in September. How do you keep a home cool when temperatures blast into the triple digits? You could just run the AC and then brace yourself for the crowbar to the knees power bill that will arrive later at your door. Or short of having a giant oak tree providing you some shade, that's it. Really, the options are few and far between, unless you do one thing to your roof. Find out what that is when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. It's been a relatively cool summer in LA so far, but we've all experienced extreme heat in our region, and it is not fun. Researchers say heat waves are likely to happen more often as the effects of climate change take hold, but there could be a solution to bringing down the temperature here. A recent study from the Department of Energy's Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory found that if all buildings in California adopted something called a cool roof by 2050, it could offset the frequency and intensity of really hot days. To explain, we have Pouya Vahmani. He's an urban environmental scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. Welcome to Take Two.
Thank you so much.
Now, let's start with a quick definition. Cool roof. What is a cool roof? What does it look like?
Cool roofs are basically some coatings or material that you install on your rooftop that reflect between 60 to 90% of the incoming solar radiation back into the space.
So is it just something colored white? What exactly does it look like? Paint a picture.
Yes, it could be either. So it could be very simple as a white paint you can go buy and paint your rooftop white. Or there are some companies that are actually working to develop these tiles that look normal, but actually reflect the specific part of the solar radiation spectrum called near infrared, which carry a lot of heat and energy. So basically, although they look like normal roofs, but they stay cooler under the sun and therefore transmit less heat to the building and to their surrounding areas.
So is it like sunscreen for your house?
Yes, exactly. It's a really shiny sunscreen.
Now, explain the science for us, though. Why is this a good way to help bring down the heat?
Okay, so cool roofs can actually reduce the impacts of climate change by 60%. So what cool roofs do here is they cool down our cities. So when the warmer and hotter heat waves are going to come because of climate change in the future, we are prepared and more resilient in the face of them.
Let's just say for a second, I didn't have those special tiles that you mentioned, and I just wanted to paint my roof white just to try and somehow replicate the effect. Would that work if I did that?
That definitely will work. If you implement those locally, you are going to be the ones who are going to benefit from it. And you don't need the entire globe to be on board with this. And only your city or neighborhood applies this, you're going to benefit from it. You're going to worry less about climate change.
I can imagine that a lot of people listening are wondering, are asking themselves, how much would something like this cost? I mean, say if I just wanted to paint my roof white, it doesn't seem like it would be a huge cost commitment. Is it?
Definitely not. So to give you an accurate answer, it requires a robust study because, first of all, it depends on the type of cool roofs you're going to install. Is it going to be, as you said, as simple as the white paint, or are you going to go with more sophisticated tiles? And also how big your roof is and how much the labor cost will be. However, what we need to consider is that, first of all, these cool roofs are shown that they protect your roof material. So it's going to expand the lifespan of your roof. And that's one cost. That's one benefit. Another benefit is going to be not only it's going to cool down the neighborhood and your area, it's going to cool down your indoor temperatures, and therefore your energy bills are going to reduce.
So potentially, let me set a scenario here. Say you have a cool roof on a street that has cool pavement. If, say, it's a 100-degree day, how much of that 100-degree heat would we be feeling?
If implemented everywhere, we show that cool roofs can reduce up to 1 to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 4 to 6 degrees Fahrenheit of air temperature. So that 100-degree heat wave or a day would feel like around 95 or 94 degree.
And some people might say, well, that's not that much of a difference. What, only 5 degrees? It's still very hot.
That's exactly why we focus on these extreme heat events. So in an extreme heat event that is like 3 or 4 or 5 days of 95 plus degree temperatures, that 5 degree temperature difference could reduce the length of that heat wave from 5 days to 3 days or 2 days. And that can make a huge difference on the public health and vulnerability of the population in that neighborhood.
What do you tell people who push back on you and say, look, this is going to affect the aesthetic of my neighborhood and of the city if we all paint our roofs white? Sell it to someone that has that attitude.
To justify such a change, we need to look at the picture that we're painting with this study. What if you don't do this? So we show that the climate that we're experiencing in, let's say, the hotter regions in Los Angeles metropolitan areas, such as San Fernando Valley and also Riverside, that's how hot it's going to be in most of LA if we don't do anything about this. However, if you want to keep the climate, or if you're living in an area that's not that hot, if you want to keep it that way, we have to go with these solutions. And these are much simpler than convincing the entire world to reduce their carbon emission.
Puya Vamani, he's an urban environmental scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. We've been speaking with him about the impact cool roofs could have on mitigating the number of heat wave exposures. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, so would you paint your roof white to bring down the temperature 4 to 5 degrees? We want to know. Head to Take Two's Facebook page and tell us. All right, that's going to do it for Take Two. We're on Twitter as well, at Take Two. You can find me there too, @AMartinezLA. That's @AMartinezLA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two, we'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.